Andrew Cuomo's governing style isn't just toxic, it's incompetent.
That's the type of government he's run. You know, it's this mixture of top-down, authoritarian-like governance and also a degree of incompetence as well, and a lot of failure. There's a lot of failure around COVID in New York, and that can't be avoided.
That's Ross Barkin. We talk with him about his book, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, the Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. Then, how does it actually work that the super rich all too often pay little to no taxes?
People with wealth over $30 million, they're the folks who are hiring this wealth defense industry and are using their wealth and power to rig the rules and rig the tax code in their favor. And so that's where I would say there's really a whole other set of rules for that super wealthy group.
That's Chuck Collins. We talk with him about his book, The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. When we spoke a few weeks ago with Ross Barkin about his exposé of New York Governor Cuomo's disastrous handling of the COVID-19 pandemic in the state, we didn't know that we would be airing the interview the same week that New York Attorney General Letitia James would come out with a bombshell report about Cuomo's sexual harassment of young female staffers and the toxic workplace environment that enabled it. But sometimes in broadcasting, the timing is perfect. But while the world is focused right now on Cuomo's predilection for preying on women, serious as it is, there's another area where the New York governor's megalomania has had far more drastic consequences, life and death consequences, for thousands of New Yorkers and their families. That's his catastrophic handling of the coronavirus pandemic in New York. Because, contrary to popular belief, Andrew Cuomo was not the COVID hero he was made out to be by an adoring public and fawning press. That was largely based on his performative posturing during his daily COVID briefings in the early months of the pandemic. In fact, as Ross Barkin brilliantly lays out in his book, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo's arrogance, corruption, and incompetence led to the deaths of many more New Yorkers than might have occurred if he had simply followed the science, the counsel of the public health community he scorned, or even the example of some other governors like Jay Inslee in Washington State. Or, if Cuomo hadn't so shredded the healthcare safety net in New York State already for years prior to the pandemic's rise. Ross Barkin is an award-winning journalist and novelist. He's a columnist for The Guardian and Jacobin, as well as a contributor to The Village Voice, The Nation, and Gothamist WNYC. We spoke with Barkin in mid-July, and then again today, August 4th, for an update after the New York AG's bombshell report. Ross Barkin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be on the show.
This book, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, The Coronavirus and the Fall of New York, brilliantly, relentlessly, and factually skewers New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's disastrous record on handling the coronavirus. It's a very closely reported book. Could you first tell us a little bit about the sources you used in your approach to reporting?
Sure. So I was very much following this story in real time. So I had the benefit of really being able to look at my old notes and my stories. You know, I had been writing about Cuomo for years, and I, of course, had been writing on the pandemic in my capacity as a journalist and a columnist. I was writing dispatches for The Nation and for other outlets. And so I really watched this story unfold week by week, month by month. And that really gave me an ability to go back and then synthesize and then add to it. So, you know, the book is a mixture of original reporting I had done from the start in March of 2020. And then I went back and interviewed people as well for the book. So, you know, where I felt there were gaps or where I wanted additional information, I went back and made phone calls and spoke to different people. And I also relied on the good reporting that had existed, you know, in various outlets, both mainstream and not, since, you know, there definitely was a real failure on the part of the media, which I get into in the book, but there were also a lot of very good reporters doing the best they could under trying circumstances and really trying to get out the truth of what happened during COVID. And they were of use as well. I think one problem with all of this was that the good reporting really did not get emphasized as much. And instead you had these faulty narratives, which really took hold in the cable TV world and in the, you know, prestige media world, whether it was national magazines and even at the New York Times and places like that.
Maybe not even at the New York Times, especially at the New York Times. You know, you talk about Ben Smith. You know, I mean, the New York Times has always had, maybe not always, but certainly during this time, lauded Cuomo and many others, you know, many New Yorkers, including myself, tuned in to hear Andrew Cuomo's daily briefings. His approval rating shot up to 77%. I was, by the way, not among those who contributed to that. I very quickly became disenchanted with some of the stuff, his approach. But I know people who swooned over his management style, which he portrayed as a man of action, forcing a feckless bureaucracy to do his bidding. Talk about Cuomo's management style, not just during COVID, but in general, and why that, in fact, turned out to be so dangerous during the pandemic.
Andrew Cuomo is someone who micromanages and politicizes facets of government that should not be politicized. He relies on a very close coterie of aides who remain in his orbit, not because they're extremely competent. They remain in his orbit because they're extremely loyal. That does not mean everyone in his orbit is incompetent. It just means that, like, a lot of, you know, leaders with authoritarian tendencies, and I'm not calling him an authoritarian, loyalty comes first. And I didn't even really get into this in the book because this would come out later on when the book was finished. The man overseeing vaccine distribution in New York State was a longtime political aide named Larry Schwartz, who had no background in science or in medicine. He was a career political operative who had been close to Cuomo for years and was given this task of overseeing how vaccines should be handed out to the various counties. And this was in, you know, the early months of this year and late last year. You have people like Melissa DeRosa, who at one time appeared on the covers of Harper's Bazaar and became a mini celebrity in her own right, you know, who is the second most powerful bureaucrat in the state. And she was given vast powers and ability to decide how COVID should be managed in New York. And she also is a, you know, career Democrat operative, you know, daughter of a lobbyist, and she's a smart person, and not denigrating her, but she is someone who is there, who exists in power because she is fiercely loyal to Andrew Cuomo. And And when you have a government like that, you can have real problems. You get situations where New York doesn't shut down quickly enough because the governor and his people don't like the mayor of New York City, who says we should shut down now. And they don't want to defer to him because they don't like Bill de Blasio. You get these like very kind of personalized, petty conflicts that override the greater decisions that should be made. And I don't think Cuomo is Donald Trump by any means. I don't think anyone is Donald Trump. But I do think there's more similarities between the two than a lot of liberal, left-leaning people would admit. And I think one of them is that both Trump and Cuomo prize loyalty above all else. And if you are blindly loyal, you'll remain. If you're not, you'll be cast out of the garden.
Yeah, and as you point out, I mean, Larry Schwartz, wasn't he also accused of hinting to county leaders that they, you know, when the whole scandals over the nursing home scandal and the sexual harassment scandals broke, which we'll talk about later, that he used a little bit of strong-arming around vaccine supply?
Yes, yes, that is correct. Larry Schwartz was politicizing in every sense how vaccines should be distributed in New York. And now we're in a period where anyone can get a vaccine and wants one. But as we know, in the early months of the year, that was not true. And New York, like other states, had erected what I thought were overly onerous regulations around who could get it, who couldn't get it. And Cuomo at one time was threatening $1 million fines for something called vaccine fraud, which meant simply that you got a vaccine if you weren't in one of these various categories that the state created. And yeah, I mean, Schwartz was the driver of all that, and he was making threats, and he was subtly, not so subtly, communicating to these county executives that they better not step out of line. I mean, that's who he is. I mean, Cuomo, everything is politics. And he's not the only governor who's like that. He's not the only executive who's like that. But, you know, what you see in his government is everything kind of moves through this political lens. And it's all about consolidating power, inspiring fear in others, and moving forward towards another term. You know, Andrew Cuomo is very much even now obsessed with winning a fourth term and staying in power as long as he possibly can. And everything he does in government is really revolves around that desire to remain in this perch as long as possible.
In your book, Ross Barkin, I hope readers will read it before they make up their minds on how they're going to vote if they're in New York for Andrew Cuomo. You are the author of The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, The Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. So one part of this is his megalomania, his demand for loyalty. Another part of this is, which you talk about, is his ineptness. And talk about the link between these two. I mean, I remember at one point, I think Andrew Cuomo finally really lost me when he said something like, "Don't trust the experts, trust me." And I heard, I learned that something like the vast majority of his public health people resigned. To me, that was very disturbing. So what are some examples of how this management style led to really inept decision-making?
There are a few different ways it really cost the city and the state. And, you know, when you think about who remains in his government, as you said, he's had many resignations on the public health side. His public health commissioner has not resigned, Dr. Howard Zucker, and he's remained in part because he's been very loyal to Cuomo. And he's been, you know, in essence, another arm of kind of this political machine and not really an independent public health official. You know, I always start at the beginning with the fact that the state of New York, like Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York City, was really downplaying the threat of COVID. Cuomo repeatedly compared it to the flu, compared it to Ebola, compared it to SARS, said the fear is worse than the virus itself. And he himself was at these press conferences at the center of the dais, making these proclamations. Cuomo was not letting independent public health experts speak at length about the threat of COVID. You contrast that with, for example, Washington State, where very early on, Jay Inslee, the governor, deputized public health officials to lead the response and to be the public face of the response, to communicate to people, this is serious, this is going to get worse. You know, you saw this in the end of February of 2020 in Washington State. And then you had days later, you know, even weeks later, Andrew Cuomo is still on stage as late as mid-March saying, this is like the flu, don't worry. And it was so divorced from reality at that point. You know, we're talking about anyone with a brain could see this was going to be very bad, and this was spreading uncontrolled. This had happened in Europe, but it happened in China, and it was going to happen here. You can just read a newspaper and see that. So you start there at the beginning, and you look at New York's slowness to implement a shutdown order, doing it after California did, even though there are many more cases. And that also speaks to Cuomo's style, that he was only going to do it on his terms. He wanted to call it New York pause. He didn't like that Bill de Blasio got out in front of him and said, it's going to be time for New York to go into a lockdown. He said, no, it's not. I make that decision, not you. And, you know, Cuomo had these remarkable emergency powers in place, which didn't really get a lot of attention. I write about in my book a bit where he could really decide unilaterally whatever it is he wanted to do in New York State. You know, there was really no place of input for the mayor, for any county executive. And so the buck stopped with him in every way. Then, of course, there's the nursing home debacle, which I haven't even gotten into yet, where New York had a very odd policy of readmitting COVID-positive patients into nursing homes, and they were discharged from hospitals. And Cuomo blamed this on the federal government, but this was not a hard federal policy. This was the policy of his government. And he argued with some plausibility that you needed to free up hospital beds by sending these people back to nursing homes. But he did not really seek any alternatives, like maybe moving some of these patients into the large temporary hospital facilities that had been set up and were largely unused, whether it was at the Jacob Javits Center in New York City in Manhattan or the Tennis Center in Queens. I mean, these largely sat empty. And then the real sin of undercounting nursing home deaths, which didn't lead to more carnage, what led to an inability to understand the extent of the death toll in New York in these nursing homes, where people who died, who got sick in a nursing home and got transported to a hospital, were not counted as nursing home deaths. And there was no logic to this. This is not how other states counted nursing home deaths. And this was kind of the beginning of Cuomo's unraveling, where, like Richard Nixon, he needed to cover up this very, you know, this reality to make himself look better, you know, certainly for his book and for the public in general. And that was not a public health decision to undercount nursing home death. This was not something any independent public health expert would have done. This was something that Andrew Cuomo and Melissa DeRosa wanted to do. So it was done, and someone like Howard Zucker merely had to play ball and follow along. And then that's the type of government he's run. You know, it's this mixture of top-down authoritarian-like governance and also a degree of incompetence as well, and a lot of failure. There's a lot of failure around COVID in New York, and that can't be avoided.
And when you say undercount, we're talking about an undercount by 50%, which is a considerable amount. And then there is the other count, how many excess deaths that there were because Cuomo went into a snit about Bill de Blasio trying to lock down New York City, I remember reading an Atlantic article that estimated, I think, some 15,000 extra deaths because of Cuomo's delay in adopting the so-called pause. And you cite that a week or two earlier could have saved 50 to 80% of the deaths. And those deaths stand at, how much are they now? Last I heard was 33,000 deaths in New York
City. Yeah, about 33, and then I think statewide about 50. Thankfully, people aren't really dying too much anymore from COVID, and that's because of the vaccine. Even now with the Delta surge, hospitalizations and deaths aren't rising to a great degree, so that's good. But yes, there was a study by Columbia University, which I cite. There was also the remarks by Tom Friedman, the former head of the CDC, and they were pretty much in agreement that an earlier shutdown saves lives. Now, people are always going to die of COVID, and I don't blame Cuomo for all the people who died of COVID in New York, because this was a terrible virus and it was going to kill people. The issue is how fast you move to contain it, how fast you move to protect people. And what you saw in Northern California was a coordinated shutdown among counties that was successful. Even though California would have problems with COVID later on, still, if you look at the per capita death toll, New York far outstripped California. California had a bigger raw death total, but it's twice as big a state. And in Northern California, where they were very effective at doing an early shutdown, the death toll was pretty small. I think at one time when I was writing, and I have to check the current numbers, but I remember for a while, San Francisco had under 1,000 deaths total. And, you know, New York had 20 to 30,000 deaths. And, you know, even when you do it on a per capita basis, New York is far more carnage. You know, similarly in Washington State, you know, Jay Inslee and the county executive in Seattle did a really good job and received very little credit relative to the amount Cuomo did for really organizing early on a effort to warn people about COVID and to sensibly close down when it was necessary. No one was perfect. You know, everyone failed at this to a degree. And there were really no great heroes. Public health experts failed. Trump failed. Cuomo failed. At the same time, there were some successes, and even New York did a good job at bending the curve once many people had died. Tragically, it came too late. That's my point, that yes, you can give Cuomo credit for implementing a shutdown order and saving life, but look at the death toll. And New York still had the second highest death toll in America. And, you know, per capita next to New Jersey had the highest death toll. So there's really little to take solace in, and especially when you think of all the people who died and the people who are left without loved ones today, there's nothing to celebrate in that sense, though Andrew Cuomo seems insistent on celebrating himself.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ross Barkin about his book, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, the Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. Now, both Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo touted New York's world-class health system early on in the epidemic, in the pandemic, as a way of saying, you know, like, it's the New York tough. We've got the greatest health system in the world, so we'll be okay. But you point out that that healthcare system is, I guess, to quote Bill de Blasio, is very much a tale of two cities. Talk about that, and talk about Cuomo's record prior to and during the pandemic. Because of his control, total control of the budget, in slashing the public health safety net.
Andrew Cuomo, as governor, and he's been governor now for over a decade, and, you know, if he finishes his term next year, he'll be governor for 12 years, you know, has been remarkably influential. And he's really done his best in New York to rein in spending, to lower taxes, you know, to kind of move in a more conservative direction. And he at times has been quite successful at that, or at least he's tried to cut this social safety net in kind of in under the radar ways, because, you know, Cuomo could never govern like a true austerity driven Republican because it is a Democratic state, but he could do as much as he could to turn the tide on the rising progressive movement in the state. So when you look at the pandemic, Cuomo really used it as a pretext to enact these devastating budget cuts that he called withholdings, that were done without any legislative input, that meant a lot of chaos at public universities, at public schools, you know, for social services. Cuomo was attempting to cut Medicaid spending during the pandemic, trying to cut Medicaid payments to hospitals. Those were fought back against, and New York was fortunate that Medicaid was not reduced to these frontline public hospitals. But, you know, this has been Cuomo's MO for a long time. And actually, as governor, he shifted more to the left than he used to be. When he came into office, he really was a third way triangulating Democrat like Clinton, very much in that mold, anti-labor, anti-progressive taxation, you know, very pro-charter school, and really against kind of this whole New Deal legacy. And he sort of had to move a bit to the left as the political realities of the state changed. He also, for a very long time, helped keep Republicans in control of the state Senate. And this was true until 2019. And there was really no way the Republicans could have stayed in power in a Democratic state without Cuomo's help. Cuomo allowed them to gerrymander their own district lines a decade ago. He helped them maneuver in the state Senate behind the scenes. He refused to help Democrats. And this really kept a lot of progressive legislation bottled up for a really long time and gave conservative Republicans a hand in the budget process every single year until 2019. And that suited Cuomo because he never wanted to go very far to the left. He was very wary of the left. And if a progressive policy measure failed, he could always blame the Republicans. So it was an arrangement that worked very well for him. And I would just add, on the austerity front, Andrew Cuomo was not the first governor to pursue hospital closures. This had been a policy since the 1990s, and in some ways is a national trend. But Andrew Cuomo certainly enthusiastically pursued the closure of poor hospitals that served working class or poor areas that did not make money because their clientele was on Medicaid, undocumented. You know, it was really serving the most vulnerable people. And Cuomo did close a hospital in Queens that could have saved people's lives years later during the pandemic. And he has never been terribly fond of the public hospital system. You know, he's very close to the private hospital operators who are skeptical of these public hospitals and would probably like to see them have even less money and less power. And that's always sort of been Cuomo's approach to healthcare, which has been privatization and attempting as much as he can to rein in Medicaid spending.
Well, yes. In fact, you point out, Ross Barkin, in The Prince, that the guy who was spearheading the hospital, quote, consolidation plan, which really means hospital shutdown plan for public hospitals, who, by the way, was a billionaire Trump supporter and mega donor to Cuomo, Alexander Roft, is connected to Northwell Health, which is one of the biggest private hospital operators in the state of New York. So here, connect the dots to the corruption, because another point about corruption was how Cuomo got immunity from liability for the nursing homes into a state budget as the pandemic was roaring into life in New York State. So talk about corruption and the impact on public health.
The liability shield was a remarkable piece of legislation that had far-reaching implications. Back in March of 2020, while COVID was first spreading and killing people, New York State was passing its annual budget, and the budget process is always done in March. The fiscal year in New York State starts in April, not in July like most states, which meant March was a extraordinarily important month in so many ways. And what always happens with the budget process, which makes New York a very backward state, is all of it gets hashed out at the last minute behind the scenes and voted on without any real ability to read what's in the budget. You know, it's done overnight in a spate of a few days. And these are thousands of pages that these legislators have to vote on. And it's done with no transparency, no hearings, really almost no oversight at all. And this is how it's been done in Albany for decades. And what usually happens in the budget is a lot of different policies and bills will be put into it. So you'll have unrelated bills that become laws in the state budget process. You know, often so state legislators don't have to take up down votes on them. They can just write them into the budget and pass them that way. So basically what happened was at the very last minute, legislators are getting ready to pass the budget and Cuomo's office inserts a provision into the budget, you know, with the assistance of the legislative leaders and not with the rank and file, that gives sweeping immunity to nursing homes and to hospitals. And this was a provision that was written by the hospital lobby, which maybe is the most powerful lobby in New York State. And this, from early March onward, gave nursing homes and hospitals a shield from all types of lawsuits. So anything related to COVID, you cannot sue if you felt a family member was mistreated or a hospital, the nursing home screwed up. And you also couldn't sue for conventional medical malpractice. This was eventually repealed, the medical malpractice part especially. But as far as I understand, it was not retroactive. So, you know, if you had a medical malpractice issue in the early months of 2020, you were out of luck. There's an immunity shield in place. And it was this level of immunity that was so sweeping that Mitch McConnell in Washington was hoping to jam into the federal budget. And you had progressive Democrats who either were not aware of what was happening in New York or were aware and just didn't care, who were denouncing aggressively Mitch McConnell's drive to give immunity to nursing home operators and to hospitals while saying nothing about the fact that it already had been done in New York State. And this happened because the hospital lobby gives Andrew Cuomo hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, in campaign contributions. I mean, New York has very loose campaign finance laws. An individual person or corporation can give at a time $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 a pop to the governor, and it's totally legal. You don't have to even do a super PAC. You can just write the check. And this is how politics is done in New York. And Cuomo has fundraised aggressively from a few different sectors in his time as governor. You know, there's the real estate industry and there's Wall Street. The other big part's the healthcare industry. The hospital lobby is key. You mentioned Northwell Health. They are the premier hospital network in the state. You know, you have a few of these big private wealthy networks and they're at the top. And they've been able to dictate healthcare policy in the state for a long time now. And there's been this, you know, blend where it's sometimes not clear where public government begins and private government ends. You have lobbyists from the healthcare sector going to work in the government. You have the reverse happening. And it can almost seem like Northwell Health and the hospital lobby is an arm of the state government. You know, it certainly feels that way. And this immunity shield happened because they have this extraordinary power and this great, you know, relationship with Andrew Cuomo. And this has really been a feature of politics in New York for a very long time.
So, finally, Cuomo is facing major scandals over sexual harassment, the nursing home death count. There's also the lesser scandal, although that might change if there's an accident on the Mario Cuomo Bridge, formerly the Tappan Zee Bridge, about Andrew Cuomo rushing to open it and there being structural integrity issues there with the bolts. Do you think that there will finally be a reckoning for Cuomo's ineptness and corruption?
Yes and no. To an extent, there's been one because his popularity has already decreased and he's now returned to the ordinary levels of support that he enjoyed before the pandemic. I do not think he'll resign, and I think it's very unlikely he can be forced from power before next year when he seeks re-election. Not optimistic about the impeachment inquiry in the assembly. I don't really trust them to stand up to him. I do think there could be a reckoning based on who runs against him next year when he runs for re-election. You know, Cuomo has never faced a competitive primary with an opponent who can spend at the level that he does. There's potential that next year you could see that happen. The candidate that I'm looking at, who I think could run competitively, is the Attorney General, Letitia James. She's currently investigating him. She's deputized investigators to look into the sexual harassment allegations, some of which seem quite serious. And she would be a formidable candidate if she stepped forward, and she would probably have a lot of support. But Cuomo at this point would still be a favorite, I think, you know, unless things really change, unless the report is really devastating, unless someone steps forward, it's Cuomo's race to lose. I think you have to operate under that assumption. And if he does manage a fourth term, there's a real fear that he could outrun all these problems. Now, I think for those who want accountability, the good news is this will probably be his hardest re-election test ever, and that there will be money and interest in stopping him. It's going to come down to who runs and what sort of money gets behind that person and how the public feels. You know, there's a lot that's going to go into this. And I'm not ready yet to say Cuomo will get the reckoning that he probably deserves. I think we're closer to that point than we would have been otherwise. And I do think these sexual harassment allegations have really hurt his reputation in many circles. But I don't bet against Cuomo. I've learned not to do that. I think he should not be underestimated. He is very smart. He's very cunning. He's cutthroat. And he is obsessed with staying in office and maintaining his power. And someone like that should not be counted out of any political fight.
So that's where we left off with Ross Barkin when we first spoke with him in mid-July about his book, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, the Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. But today, August 5th, as we produce the show, we called Barkin up on Zoom for his take on not the fall of New York, but on what looks to be the fall of Andrew Cuomo. Stay tuned for that after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can listen again or find web-only features like extended interviews. Love Writer's Voice? Please rate or review us on your podcast app. It really helps to get the word out about the show. After New York Attorney General Letitia James released her damning report about Governor Cuomo's sexual harassment of staffers and other young women, I was curious to know if Ross Barkin still feels, as he told us,
I don't bet against Cuomo. I've learned not to do that.
So I called him up on Zoom to ask him whether he thought Cuomo's prospects for staying in power had changed.
Yes, his prospects have definitely changed. This is before the release of the Attorney General's report. That was always the caveat that depending on what this report said, it could really pose deep challenges for him. And the report really validated a lot of the allegations against him. And now you're seeing a lot of elected officials turn on him, including in the state assembly, where the impeachment threat has gotten much more serious. Cuomo is not going to resign immediately. That's not how he operates. And he's going to drag this out probably as long as it's possible for him to. But there's no doubt now that given the report and the details it has on his record of harassing and groping women, that it will be very difficult for him to successfully run for office again. And there is a possibility now he could be impeached. And if he is impeached, it's going to be very hard for him to survive because the Senate has the votes to convict. There are enough senators on the Republican and Democratic side, and the Senate is controlled by Democrats overwhelmingly, to get the 2/3 number to remove him. So I do think he is imperiled. I will add, it is true, it's difficult to entirely bet against him and write him off, but I do think he is in deep, deep trouble.
One other thing that may have changed, although I think it was also changing for a while, is in your book, The Prince, you point out that the New York Times, was a part of the, shall we say, the crowd of acolytes praising Cuomo's performance during the pandemic and in other times. They began to fall away earlier than this. But I was struck by the number of articles in the New York Times yesterday, the day that the press conference by the AG about the sexual harassment allegations against Cuomo was held. How many articles in the New York Times really lambasted him? What about the press? Do you feel like he can't come back to charm them again?
Yes, I think it's going to be extremely hard for him to be able to win over reporters and get the coverage softened. And one part of it was charm and one part of it was threats. Cuomo was the most powerful politician in the state. And for those covering him, the beat reporters especially, they were reliant on access to his administration. And so his people could always berate and threaten reporters with the implication that they had the power of the executive behind them. Cuomo does not have that power anymore. So the media smells blood. Formerly praise-filled reporters and columnists and editors and editorial boards have now seen fit to report what's going on, report very aggressively and adversarially on it. And I think that's in part because Cuomo is so weakened now. I think of the example of Newsday, which is the newspaper of Long Island. Newsday has always had a pretty cozy relationship with Cuomo, the ownership and the editorial board. And throughout the pandemic, would go out of its way to spin Cuomo in a positive light. And Newsday was not alone. I'm just using them as an example. They had a very damning front page today. I saw it online that lays out the allegations in really stark detail and makes it clear that Cuomo was found culpable by this attorney general's report. So there are no news outlets that are defending him anymore, and he doesn't have a reliable organ to go to. So I don't see how he comes back from that and wins over the media again. It doesn't seem plausible at this point.
Well, Ross Barkin, thanks so much for this update and for talking with us earlier about your book, The Prince.
Yeah, no problem.
You can read an excerpt of Ross Barkin's The Prince by going to writersvoice.net. Business mogul and convicted felon Leona Helmsley once said, "We don't pay taxes, only the little people pay taxes. Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, has had years where he paid zero taxes. How do billionaires like Bezos, Elon Musk, Donald Trump, and others dodge taxes while the burden of keeping the government up and running falls on the merely well-off and below? That's what Chuck Collins sets out to explain in his book, The Wealth Hoarders. Chuck Collins is the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org. Well, Chuck Collins, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be with you.
This book really comes at a very opportune time, The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. You start the book actually with your own personal history. You inherited a fortune. I believe Oscar Mayer was your great-grandfather, is that right?
That's right.
So when you were in your early 20s, you went to a weekend conference for people with inherited wealth. It was 1983. Why did you go, and what did you find out there?
Well, you know, I was a young person. I had learned that I was going to, you know, win. I'd won the lottery at birth. At some point, pretty soon after that, I was going to inherit enough wealth that I wouldn't have to work. And I was just, you know, I also, though, had worked in a refugee camp in El Salvador. I had been influenced by Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker movement. And so I was kind of in a pickle, which is my ethical compass was pointing one way, and my life circumstances were about to make me a beneficiary of this system of inherited wealth that I was questioning. So what was great about that gathering was I met other people that were in the same boat. I met other people who were inheritors of wealth, but had progressive social change values. And so that was a revelation for me, really, to meet others. And it was at that conference I had already been thinking, well, you know, maybe I should just give away these assets. But at that conference, I kind of voiced that for the first time and had a number of important elders, people who had a lot more life experience than me, saying, no, don't do that. That would be reckless and irresponsible and even selfish. So that was the story that I used to sort of set up this discussion of how families are encouraged to hold on to wealth.
And in fact, you did give away, what was it, $500,000, which was like, you know, probably four times that now, if not more, at the age of 26. You did give it away. And you decided you didn't follow their advice to protect the capital. I mean, protect the, what is it called?
The principal. But yes, it was the capital. They call it the corpus, kind of like the body, you know, of wealth. The important advice to a young or to any wealthy person is, you can do whatever you want with the income. You can be, you know, quirky and reckless and, you know, whatever. But don't touch the principal. Don't touch the asset corpus.
And so it was at that conference that you discovered what you call the money river and the wealth defense industry, or WDI, which is all dedicated to protecting that corpus. Tell us about the wealth defense industry. You're not really aiming here to talk about inequality, which you do talk about in general. You have the website inequality.org. As well as all your work for IPS, but you zero in on this wealth defense industry. What is it and who is it?
Yeah, and my whole interest in this really is, how is it that inequality gets entrenched over time? And so one of the ways that happens is wealthy families get help. They have professional help. They don't rig the tax rules themselves. They hire people to do that. And the wealth defense industry are the tax attorneys, estate planners, wealth managers, accountants, people who work in what are called family offices, which are offices devoted to the wealth management activities of the super wealthy. That is the sector of professionals. I say they are paid millions to hide trillions. And they have a whole toolbox of tools that they use to
hide or sequester or put wealth outside the reach of taxes. They use offshore tax havens like the ones we've heard about from the Panama Papers. They create trusts. They create kind of financial transactions that are supposed to look like real legitimate business transactions, but actually they're just tax dodges. That's their expertise, is kind of move. It's helping lubricate or enable the shell game of tax avoidance.
And we'll delve more into exactly what that means. But one of the things you start out right away is talking about how these gatekeepers of the industry really kind of monitor the fuzzy lines between legal and illegal. And in one of the first chapters of the book is about, you know, we all talk about how the rich evade taxes and it's all perfectly legal, but sometimes it's not perfectly legal and the same system protects both. Tell us about the case of the Blue Hippo and why did you put that kind of right up in the beginning of the book?
Well, Francesca, you're making an important point, which is people in the wealth defense industry will say, everything we do is legal. We're just helping our clients obey the law, take advantage of all the loopholes that are in the law. Nothing wrong here. But it's a funky tap dance, if you will, because these are the folks that they are actively writing the rules. So you have everything from wealthy families using dynasty trusts and essentially subverting the spirit and intent of the law. But you also have actual criminals and people who are stealing money from others. Or in the case of the Blue Hippo story I tell, there's a guy who named Joseph Renson. He starts a company that sells computers through marketing on late night television. And the basic pitch is there's a kind of cute dancing blue hippo and it says, hey, do you want to buy a computer? Do you have damaged credit? Call this 800 number. Give us your bank account. We'll take a little bit of money out of your bank account every week. And once you hit a certain point, we'll ship you a computer. And so, you know, it's 11 o'clock at night and people are calling in and giving their bank account information. The money is taken out of their accounts, but weeks and months go by and all of a sudden they realize there's no computer coming and it's a scam. And this is an example where a company is created to fleece working class people out of their money. So when consumers and state attorney generals and others pursued this company, they declared bankruptcy. And then when they started to go after the individual involved, he had moved a lot of this money to asset protection trusts in the Cook Islands. The Cook's Islands are somewhere east of New Zealand. And they are one of these offshore tax havens and debtors' paradises where it's very difficult to enforce the law. Anyway, I tell that story because it isn't just about avoiding taxes. Sometimes it's about avoiding responsibility for criminal activity or hiding money from a spouse. You know, this is one of the other case studies are, and they're usually men who are fleecing their ex-wives or ex-spouses by using a lot of the same tools that the wealth defense industry uses to avoid taxes. So it's not just about taxes. It's about how do the super rich avoid responsibility for their actions in a way that the rest of us are responsible.
Yes. And I think it really is fascinating. I mean, there is just the interpenetration of criminal activity with legal activity that really ought to be criminal. You know, the New York Times and ProPublica just published, just talking about taxes, published a bombshell report about how the richest people in the world pay little to no taxes. And you wrote in an op-ed for CNN about this that the report shows that 25 billionaires paid a true tax rate of just 3.4% on their gains between 2014 and 2018, and some of them paid zero taxes, including, our former president. So those ways are perfectly legal. Talk about the two-tier tax system.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what's important to realize is most people don't get to play games with their taxes. In fact, you know, you have your income tax withheld from your paycheck. So by the time tax day comes around, you've probably already paid. And the tax code is pretty simple for the bottom 90%. And even it's hard to game it unless you have a lot of investments, a lot of business ownership interests, and the ability to kind of move money around. And I would argue that it's really the people in the top 0.1%, people with wealth over $30 million, they're the folks who are hiring this wealth defense industry and are using their wealth and power to rig the rules and rig the tax code in their favor. And so that's where I would say there's really a whole other set of rules for that super wealthy group. So when people say, well, we should simplify the tax code, it's pretty simple for most folks, and that we should be cracking down and simplifying the games that the super wealthy play around their taxes.
Well, often when they say, let's simplify the tax code, they talk about a flat tax, which is not what you're talking about. Is that right?
That's right. In fact, we have, you know, again, the tax rate is one of the simplest parts of the tax code. It's getting to what is your taxable income that is where all the gaming and complexity comes in. And, you know, if you were going to look at the tax code and maybe it's, you know, whatever, 10,000 pages, 9,700 of those pages are all about the various ways in which rich people can move their money into in and out of different things. And the reason that the ProPublica study is so stunning and points to the problem in the tax code, which is we focus on income, whereas we really should also be focusing on wealth and income from wealth and the way in which wealth is growing but is untaxed within our current tax system. That's how the super rich really pay so little taxes.
Yes, I mean, I believe they talk about the fact that if you're that wealthy, the way you get your kind of spending money is to borrow it, which means it goes tax-free. In fact, you can write off a debt while you're keeping your money nice and safe in its investments.
Yeah, that's a real simple one. It makes sense. Let's say, Francesca, you bought a share of Berkshire Hathaway stock. You were really smart and you bought it in 1980 for $1,000. And now you have, you know, $1 billion. None of that wealth, that increase in wealth has been taxed, because you're still holding your one share of Berkshire Hathaway stock. What, instead of selling that and paying a capital gain, you simply borrow against it and then deduct the interest you're paying as well. So this is a way in which, and this is one of the kind of simple gimmicks that the wealthy use so that they don't have to pay capital gains taxes. But that's just one of dozens of little shell games that the super rich play because they can, because they have all this professional help.
Say some of the others. And the professional help is costly, which is why it's just the 1/10 of why it's worth it to them to do that. But for somebody who's merely in the top 10%, they can't afford it.
That's right. I mean, these are expensive services. Now, another common device right now is called a dynasty trust. And, you know, what's fascinating about the ProPublica study is we're looking at the money that we know about. But what I would argue is there are trillions of dollars that are not even in the equation when it comes to taxes, because they've been placed into trusts. Now, trusts are kind of complicated ownership systems. I might create a trust, say, if I have a child who has a special need and I'm not going to be around forever, and so I want to make sure that they have some money to live on after I die. But I'm not going to give the control of that to them. I'm going to have you, Francesca, be my trustee, and you will watch out and protect my child's interests. That is the typical trust, and that's sort of the justification for it. But what the super rich do is they play all kinds of games. They will actually create trusts for themselves. They will create trusts for children, but they will put the assets, this vast amount of wealth, into what I would call an ownership limbo. So from a tax point of view, it's not clear who the owner is, who's the beneficiary. And that's part of this vast trillions of dollars are in these trusts. And then states like South Dakota repeal the rules that limit the lifespan of a trust so they can exist for centuries. So now wealthy people are creating trusts for their, you know, unborn great-great-grandchildren. The money will continue to flow down this family line. It will not be subject to any inheritance or estate tax. And it will just keep building and building in these trusts. So think about this, you know, 150 years from now, you're going to have trillions of dollars in one family's wealth trust. And these are, you know, these are forms of power. This isn't just a lot of money. This is a form of political, social, and economic power that we should be very concerned about.
Yeah, so talk about the cost to the rest of us when the richest people in the world pay little to no taxes.
There's really two reasons we should be really concerned. One is obvious, which is when the wealthy don't pay their fair share, they are shifting responsibility onto everyone else. So the rest of us are picking up the slack. We're paying the bills, whether it's caring for veterans or infrastructure or whatever. Or, you know, because of the shortage of money, you know, we will, you know, pretty soon we will begin to hear the familiar austerity chorus. There is no money. There's not enough money. We can't afford this. And that's what starves the public realm and makes us ill-prepared for things like pandemics and hurricanes and the challenges that we're going to be facing. So it really does matter, because the super rich, by sequestering their money and avoiding taxes, are taking the vast amount of treasure out of society. And the other is the power question. I said that there's been such a growth in this concentration of wealth and power at the top, particularly in the last 15 years, the billionaire class. You know, now we have 710 billionaires in the United States. Just during the pandemic alone, their wealth has gone up $1.6 trillion. And that's power. Power to influence and own media, power to shape our political and democratic institutions, philanthropic power. Some of these folks put their money into a private foundation and we all say, oh, isn't that great? They're so generous. But that their charity giving becomes an extension of their private power. So those are all the reasons that this is threatens our democracy. And they use that power to change tax rules and block public spending that would create opportunities for everyone else. So those are the reasons we should be very alarmed by these trends.
And Chuck Collins, in The Wealth Hoarders, you also point out how this... these evasion of taxes, this wealth hoarding, empowers kleptocrats, which you call kleptocrats. Talk about kleptocratic capital.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, a really important other reason to be concerned is, particularly at the global level, this system of wealth hiding enables, you know, we talked about Blue Hippo, here's just one person, but, you know, the system helps the Russian oligarchs, the dictators from mineral-rich countries that are kind of stealing money from their own people. Where do they go with that? Well, they spirit it out of those countries using this same system of offshore tax havens, anonymous shell companies. And actually, they bring huge amounts of it to the United States. We are a very attractive destination for kleptocratic capital because we have a really generally stable and from a wealth point of view, a good wealth management system. And people buy real estate and jewelry and, you know, particularly luxury real estate, and they bid up the cost of housing in certain marketplaces. So we see huge chunks of the economy now being purchased and owned by offshore interests, and a lot of it owned by anonymous shell companies. And we happen to know a good amount of that is money that has been stolen basically from people around the world. You know, we talk a lot about global poverty, but we should be very concerned about global plunder and the way in which wealthy elites in all these societies use this same system to steal from their own people.
a lot of us know about these super high-rise apartment buildings in New York City on the edge of Central Park that tower over everything and, you know, cut off the sun to the peons below. Many of them are owned by LLCs. And, you know, from what I hear, they're part of this kind of money laundering. But you say it goes far beyond that. I mean, New York is, you know, is an unaffordable city or was before the pandemic. The pandemic actually has helped to make it a bit more affordable. But this really goes nationwide to increase our housing crisis. So connect the dots for us.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our communities, and as we emerge from the pandemic, are experiencing really acute housing crisis. And there's all these invisible giants. There's the second, short-term rental industry, the Airbnb, you know, removing rental property from the housing market for short-term rental. There are just the forces of other gentrification, rich people moving into cities, bidding up the cost of housing. Add to that this global glut of money that's funneling into our local housing markets. You know, the anonymous billionaires from around the world looking to park their money. They're not looking to necessarily to live in housing. They're just looking for places to park money so it holds its value. And you see this now in most coastal cities, and now Austin and Denver and other places are seeing it. And that is disrupting our local housing markets. It's bidding up the cost of land and housing. It's putting, you know, people, we're putting a lot of resources into building empty skyscrapers when we should be building affordable housing. It's sort of siphoning and misallocating resources, and it's fueling the existing housing problems. So this is one of the ways in which these wealth inequalities at the global level are not good for most of us who are trying to survive and live in metropolitan areas.
So, Chuck Collins, in The Wealth Hoarders, you don't just talk about the problem, you also talk about some solutions. What can we do about this? You talk about some pressure points to change the system. Why don't we start there?
Yeah, and I would just underscore, this system is cracking. It may seem like it's this, oh, there's nothing we can do. The rich have always, you know, hidden their money. They always have help. There's no way, there's nothing we can do. We actually, there's a bunch of things happening now that are moving in the right direction. One is, I'll just say, there are people inside the industry who are realizing that they don't want to be doing this work. They don't want to be getting up every morning and just helping the billionaire class get richer. And some of them are defecting. The reason we know about the ProPublica leaks is because someone leaked data from within the IRS. We learn about the Panama Papers and all these other, how these games work, because people inside that industry are being whistleblowers and sharing information and leaking it to journalists. And there are disgruntled and disaffected people that I'm talking to who work in that industry who are telling me how we can fix it. And they're working with people like Senator Bernie Sanders to rewrite laws to shut down the hidden wealth system. So a couple important pressure points. One is enforcement. The IRS has been decimated in its ability to oversee this system, particularly the shell games of the rich. President Biden has proposed spending $80 billion over the next 10 years to, you know, rebuild the capacity of the IRS to follow the money, shut down some of these illicit transactions, audit the super rich who are playing these games. That's really important. A second pressure point is what I would call corporate transparency. Let's eliminate the whole idea of an anonymous shell company. Let's require disclosure of beneficial ownership. And here again, at the end of 2020, Congress passed the Corporate Transparency Act, requiring companies to disclose who their real owners are to the Treasury Department. And we're in the process now. I'm part of the coalitions that are working to make sure that law has teeth, that it also is expanded to include trusts and partnerships. So that's a key pressure point. Third pressure point is just shutting down some of these trusts and transactions. There's a whole alphabet soup of these various trusts that the wealth defense industry uses. Senator Bernie Sanders, in his proposed
update to the estate tax, the inheritance tax law, includes a whole bunch of provisions that would meaningfully close down some of these hidden wealth escape hatches, to the point where the wealth defense industry is sounding the alarm bells, saying, oh, we can't have this law pass. And the final pressure point is global. We just need to come together across borders and form treaties with, starting with the UK, starting with England, because we have enormous, the US and the UK have enormous influence over this global hidden wealth system. And a really fascinating first step is Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen is saying, let's have a global corporate minimum tax. That would require a whole level of new disclosure. All these global companies would not be able to pit countries against each other in a race to the bottom. So those are a couple of really meaningful pressure points. They're all in process. They're all things that your listeners can get involved in and call your members of Congress and say, we want to eliminate this two-tier tax system, one, the system where the rich make their taxes optional, and we want you to support these meaningful efforts. And that's the good news. Things are moving in the right direction.
Well, let me ask you about that global tax that Biden proposed and talked about when he went to England. It's only 15%. Is that even meaningful?
Well, the fact that it's there, it would be a global corporate minimum tax would mean that Apple computer company, Apple, would have to disclose how much taxes they pay in each of their countries where they do business. That level of disclosure will be really meaningful. You know, 15% is incredibly low, but actually a lot of companies that we're finding out are paying zero. You know, a lot of these global companies, 55 global companies in 2020 paid zero corporate taxes because they were able to game this system. So 15% is better than zero. It's not as good as 21%, which was the floor number that was floated before. But what I think is significant is you get this system in place. You get this system put in place that will help shut down or help, you know, kind of monitor and disclose the levels of taxes that are being paid. And then, you know, maybe then there's a global push to raise that floor.
Mm. Yeah. And you just wrote a piece, as I mentioned before, you wrote a piece for CNN, The Rich Got Richer While Millions Lost Their Livelihoods. It's time for a wealth tax. So explain the wealth tax. Now, this is different than the corporate tax. What kind of wealth tax are you calling for? And is this like the one that Elizabeth Warren has called for?
Yeah, I think a missing ingredient in our current tax system is a tax on assets. We do tax inheritance, inherited wealth at a very high level. You know, family wealth over $23 million is subject to an estate tax. But Senator Warren's proposal is an annual wealth tax, 2% on wealth over $50 million, 3% on wealth over $1 billion. And it sounds like a modest wealth tax, which it is, but it would really, over time, begin to slow this democracy distorting concentration of wealth. So in addition to, you know, fixing the income tax, taxing capital gains at the same rate as income from work, we should have an annual wealth tax. But it won't be meaningful unless we can shut down this hidden wealth system and some of these games that the rich play. But it is absolutely should be part of the menu of how we restore fairness to the tax system.
And we should tell our listeners that if you want to know more, they can also go to a new report that you co-wrote from IPS, Silver Spoon Oligarchs, How America's 50 Largest Inherited Wealth Dynasties Accelerate Inequality. Would you like to leave us with kind of one last thing? What is the best thing that we should do right now to begin pushing those pressure levers?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pressure point right now in the current moment is standing up for President Biden's proposal to pay for the infrastructure bill with increases on taxes on the wealthy, including enforcement. That is what's currently on the debate. The Republicans hate that idea. They hate the idea that corporations should have to pay any more taxes, that many of them are paying zero. So I think in the current moment, it's letting members of Congress know and writing letters to the editor and talking to our neighbors and saying, yeah, we need to make investments in infrastructure and they should be paid for by restoring taxes on the super rich. And yeah, I would invite your listeners, check out inequality.org as a website and a resource. That's where you'll find information. We just did a briefing paper on dynasty trusts that we, you know, if people are interested in what we talked about. And there's a little page called wealthhoarders.com to learn more about the book. And we even have a couple of pithy little videos on some of the themes in the book. So those are good follow-up resources. And inequality.org, we put out a newsletter every week that has the action of the week, where we encourage people to be engaged. It's not just write Congress. Sometimes it's, you know, engage other players, other stakeholders in the system. So that's another way that people can take meaningful action.
Oh, that's great. And we will link to that on the website at writersvoice.net. Well, Chuck Collins, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. It's just been, let's say, a wealth of information that we will not hoard. The book is The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Francesca, for keeping the information flowing.
Chuck Collins. Go to writersvoice.net for links to the report from IPS, which he co-wrote, Silver Spoon Oligarchs, How America's 50 Largest Inherited Wealth Dynasties Accelerate Inequality. You'll also find links to inequality.org and to his book, The Wealth Hoarders. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.